From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. Watchdog groups are speaking out against last night's vote by House Republicans to weaken the Office of Congressional Ethics. The move would rename the body the Office of Congressional Complaint Review, strip it of its independence, and put it under the control of the House Ethics Committee. The full House of Representatives votes on the issue today. President-elect Donald Trump criticized the timing of the move, tweeting that Congress should focus on other things first. Well, Lisa Gilbert is with the nonpartisan Watchdog Public Citizen. She's director of their Congress Watch Division. Lisa, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, explain to me, what's Public Citizen's reaction to what's happened to the Congressional Ethics Office?
Disdain and concern. Certainly, the Ethics Office has proven incredibly valuable. It's opened up the process. It's shown a light on what has previously been opaque and immobile about congressional ethics. And it's pretty shocking to see the very first action of a brand new Congress doing away with its own ethics watchdog.
Well, I'm seeing here reaction from Speaker Ryan. While he spoke out against the move, actually, he also defended the amendment at the same time in a statement saying that it's actually going to provide greater due process rights for members of Congress who do come under investigation.
Yes, he does seem to be speaking out of both sides of his mouth a little bit on this one. It's certainly an unpopular move to do away with any kind of ethical protections, so I'm sure he doesn't want to be seen as wholeheartedly supporting it. But on the other hand, his caucus has moved ahead, and so he needs to kind of be in line with the rest on this move since it's part of the rules package. So it's, you know, we're not happy to see him just not robustly defending the Office of Congressional Ethics.
Well, so let me read a little bit more of his statement, though, because he says it does not remove the responsibility of the office to review complaints, carry out investigations, and make referrals to the Ethics Committee. The office will continue to operate in the new year and provide public accountability to Congress. So specifically, what changes are being made that Public Citizen finds concerning or worrying?
That is right. It does not completely do away with the responsibilities of the office, but it does, in most important ways, defang it and take away what was its intended purpose, which is to spur the House Ethics Committee, which has long been a very silent and inactive committee, to take action. And so first, just by changing the name, I think is a little bit of a slap in the face. You know, they're not just intended to review complaints. They're intended to actually investigate ethical violations as they see them. So in and of itself, it kind of initially shows where they're coming from. But then they've put the Office of Congressional Ethics, previously an independent body, under the House Ethics Committee, which is the entity they refer all of their work to spur official investigation. So what that means is those members that sit on the Ethics Committee will be able to quash anything that the OCE or the new Office of Complaints brings to them. So it just does away with that independent watchdog action that the OCE has been so good at and really what was its intended goal. It also gives them the ability to shut down any investigation that might touch on criminal violations, which is potentially a pretty big swath of what OCE has investigated. It does things like take away their ability to have a press person. So, you know, doesn't allow them to communicate to the public what's happening and what types of investigations they're undertaking. So I think systematically looking to undermine and defang the office rather than completely do away with it is how I'd characterize this attack.
Well, one of the things I'm seeing is that congressional Republicans are saying that perhaps the Office of Congressional Ethics was overzealous in its mission. And they were, quote, you know, tired of seeing names being dragged through the mud. Is that a legitimate mm-hmm. complaint?
We don't think so. I think, you know, it's not surprising that those who are looked at or scrutinized for ethical violations feel that they wish they weren't and they wish it wasn't public. You know, it's certainly not a fair critique when it comes from those who have been investigated. Certainly from our perspective, from the outside, you know, the House Ethics Committee was incredibly inactive for years. There were only 5 disciplinary actions from 06 to 08. And then once OCE was created from, 2009 to now, we've seen 20 disciplinary actions. So there's been increased movement. There's been increased scrutiny of members, and I'm not surprised that they don't like it.
What do you think the consequences will be of these changes?
I mean, it's hard to say, but certainly, you know, our fear is that we'll move back towards an era where the House Ethics Committee most closely resembles six people sitting in a room with guns, unwilling to fire first. You know, no one wants to take action against fellow members. No one wants to, you know, critique other folks within the House. And so it's, you know, without the OCE to prod activity, you know, I think what we're likely to see is far less scrutiny of unethical behavior.
Lisa Gilbert is with Public Citizens Congress Watch Division. Lisa, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, it's a new year, and as of this past Sunday, the first day of 2017, hairstylists and cosmetologists in Illinois are required to have formal training in recognizing domestic abuse. Without it, salons will not be able to renew their operating licenses. The idea of mandatory training came from Chicago Says No More. That's an organization raising awareness about domestic abuse. The law, the first in the country, was introduced by Illinois State Senator Bill Cunningham because of the special relationship women have with their hairstylists. Senator Cunningham joins us from the State House in Chicago. Senator, welcome.
Thank you.
And we hear you were approached by this domestic abuse group, Chicago Say No More. But you already had a sense of this relationship that women have with their headdresses because of your wife?
That's correct. The group, Chicago Says No More, came to visit me and a colleague, State Representative Fran Hurley, and they presented this idea to us, and it immediately resonated with me because of my wife's experience as a hairdresser many years ago. She frequently had clients who would share intimate details of their lives with her, and on some occasions, those details involved being victims of domestic violence or sexual assault.
Right. And so tell us how this new law will work, because I can hear people saying, well, wait a second, hairdressers aren't trained to give social worker advice, or you don't want to put someone in the middle of a domestic violence situation. So what exactly does it require?
It requires a licensed cosmetologist in the state of Illinois to undergo 1 hour of training when their license is up for renewal. They currently have to take 14 hours of training on a number of subjects. This will just add domestic violence recognition to that list of subjects.
And what would they learn?
Well, they're going to learn how to recognize signs of domestic violence. And more importantly, they're going to be given advice on what to do when confronted with those situations and how they can best get their client help if their client needs help.
So they're taught how to recognize warning signs. Might that be just someone saying something to you? Or, I mean, this is where people might worry it gets into slippery territory. If a hairdresser thinks she sees a bruise on someone's neck and assumes that there's domestic violence or brings it up, you could get in some hot water if, A, that person does not want to share anything with you, or, B, it has nothing to do with violence.
Well, one of the things that the hairdressers will be advised of in these training sessions is not to intervene if their client is showing no signs that they want the hairdresser to intervene. That's an important part of the training that they'll undergo. I think what we're trying to get at is to address the frustration that my wife faced many years ago when she was a hairdresser. And that is, you're told by your client a number of details about some real problems in your life, and then the hairdresser is left with sort of a dilemma in that they want to help. They want to give more than just the sympathetic ear, but they're not really sure what to do. This would inform the hairdresser on steps they can take to enable their client to get help if they want help.
So maybe they could hand out a pamphlet, but not get involved outside of the salon because it could be dangerous.
That's exactly right. And we don't want them to get involved in a situation if they feel like it might be dangerous. We also want to stress that we are not requiring any hairdresser to get involved if they do not want to. In fact, we specifically wrote into the new law an immunity clause that says a hairdresser or licensed cosmetologist cannot be held liable civilly or criminally if they fail to take action when a client provides them with some sort of information regarding an incident.
What are you hearing from stylists?
We've heard nothing but positive things from various stylists. I think that the only opposition we've run into is from individuals who really sort of misunderstand the intent of the law and feel that we're trying to encourage hairstylists to get involved in these situations. We're not. We're just attempting to give them information that will help them help their clients.
because they already are involved in many cases.
That's correct. You know, I've made the analogy, there's the old sort of cultural cliche about a man going into a bar and his bartender acting as sort of his armchair psychologist, dispensing advice to him. Mm-hmm. Women are more likely to develop that kind of trusting relationship that a man might have with his bartender with their hairstylist. They spend a lot of hours with them over a number of years, and they develop a friendship. So it shouldn't be surprising that these sort of intimate details could come out in those settings. And we just want to make sure that the hairstylists who hear these stories from their clients know how to react.
Yeah. And we should point out there is this kind of thinking, and there are programs elsewhere in the country. There's Cut It Out. That's one run by the Professional Beauty Association. It's about raising awareness about domestic violence among its membership. But this is a lot, requiring hairstylists and cosmetologists in Illinois to have formal training to recognize domestic abuse. And then, as we've been hearing, they can offer some resources if they want to. And the bill was introduced by Illinois State Senator Bill Cunningham. Bill, thank you.
Thank you.
The sentencing phase of Dylan Roof's trial begins tomorrow in Charleston, South Carolina. He will serve as his own attorney as jurors decide whether he should receive the death penalty. Roof was convicted of killing 9 black parishioners at a church Bible study in 2015. Cynthia Graham Hurd was one of Roof's victims, and her brother, Melvin Graham, wants Roof to get the death penalty.
She had absolutely no chance to live. None of them had any chance to live. If this doesn't rise to the occasion of the death penalty, then what does?
Alexandra Olgan has been following the trial for South Carolina Public Radio, and she joins us now. And first of all, Alexandra, yesterday Dylan Roof had yet another competency hearing about whether or not he could serve as his own attorney during the sentencing phase. What happened?
So, yes, he did have a second competency hearing, and the judge ruled again that he is still competent. A psychiatrist evaluated him over New Year's weekend for several hours and found that there had been no significant changes to his mental state, and he's able to represent himself. Now, the hearing was closed to the public, so we don't have any more details than what was in that order.
Mm. Now, during the guilt phase of his trial, Roof momentarily wanted to serve as his own attorney, but then changed his mind. Do we know why he wants to be his own attorney during the sentencing phase now?
We don't know the details of his strategy, but we know he wants control because he sent the judge a handwritten note right after he decided to represent himself for the sentencing phase, saying he doesn't want to introduce any mental health evidence. And his lawyers speculated in a court filing that that's why he wants to represent himself. Now, we know from the first competency hearing that Roof said he wanted control over what his lawyers said in court. And the judge said, well, you know, that's not really how it works. Your lawyers have to be able to represent you and have some autonomy. And then Dylan Roof said, well, I still have the right to represent myself. So we know he's been thinking about this for a while and he wants control.
Well, in just a couple seconds that we have, the government plans to call 38 witnesses. Do we know when a jury might give us any kind of decision?
The judge speculated about 10 days. Of course, we don't know how long the jury is going to take to deliberate. It can range. But with Roof defending himself and not introducing any evidence, we are pretty much guaranteed to have a shorter trial.
Well, Alexandra Olgan is with South Carolina Public Radio. Alexandra, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, as Roof's sentencing hearing begins, or sentencing hearings, I should say, begins, we wondered how this trial and the man who claimed he wanted to start a race war is being viewed by white supremacists. Robert Futrell is a professor of sociology at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and co-author of American Swastika Inside the U.S. White Power Movement's Hidden Space of Hate. Professor Futrell, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you.
So first of all, give us a sense about what white supremacist, white nationalist groups are saying right now, whether it's online or offline. What are they saying about the trial? Are they following Dylan Roof's trial closely?
They do seem to be following it. They followed it since he had the massacre. And you know, he's a complicated person within the movement. Some people talk about him as sacrificing himself for the white race, as a fed-up white man who knows the truth about racialism. Some think he's pushed them closer to what they call the fate that lies ahead, which they imagine is a race war. And, you know, they talk about white genocide, and they also talk about exterminating those who would promulgate white genocide, which means blacks, Jews, that sort of thing. On the other hand, some feel that Dylan Roof brought unwanted attention, that it's a bad tactic to engage in the violence right now or when he did, that it brings the kind of spotlight that many of those who call themselves white nationalists or the alt-right don't want because they're seeking more legitimate forms of power.
Interesting. Because one of the things that I have been wondering is, you know, how is the fact that Dylann Roof has said that he wants to represent himself during his sentencing phase? And, you know, there have been indications that should that happen, he's not going to really present any kind of argument on his own behalf to the jury. I mean, you mentioned that some in the white supremacist movement are seeing Dylann Roof as sacrificing himself. I mean, is there a possibility that there are corners of this movement that might look upon him as a martyr if he does receive the death penalty?
Oh, sure. And that may be what Roof himself is thinking. To not take counsel, to avoid a mental health assessment, those things. He doesn't feel like he's wrong. And he feels like his actions stand for themselves. His manifesto is out there. And I think that he feels, to the extent we can sort of get inside his mind, but I think that he feels that his martyrdom is the meaning for what he's, for him, accomplished, so to speak.
So, Professor Futrell, then talk a little bit more about what this means, given where Dylann Roof first encountered white supremacist ideology. Because remind us, it was largely online through websites such as the one run by the Council of Conservative Citizens, right?
That's right. The Council of Conservative Citizens is one of the places that he went, and he cites them as inspiration. I mean, that group itself is a modern version of the old white citizens' councils formed by segregationists in the 1950s and 60s. It's they're what Kelly Baker recently called in the New York Times part of the white-collar supremacy. Mm-hmm. These are, you know, so-called upstanding, respectable, some people connected to them are connected to institutional politics. They feel that God is the author of racism. They think race mixing is blasphemy. And, you know, they condemned the killings, but they also said that Roof had legitimate grievances, so they didn't completely disavow themselves. But the Council of Conservative Citizens is just one of many sort of places online where one can go and not just read about, but interact with other white supremacists. So Roof has been characterized as being self-radicalized, and I really take issue with that connotation. He acted alone, but the ideas that you know, he reflects in his manifesto and that inspired him come from a much broader culture of virulent racist, anti-Semitic ideas, and out of this we can expect, and we've seen it before, people spinning out of this culture, people like Dylann Roof or Wade Michael Page, who had the massacre at the Sikh temple in Milwaukee, or Frazier Glenn Miller in Kansas City, spinning out of this culture, lashing out at their racial enemies to quote-unquote save white America. And create this culture that is really persistent, quite frankly. I mean, for quite a while, it's been under the radar. We don't pay a lot of attention to it. We do when somebody like Dylann Roof strikes out, but then we go back to worrying about, you know, terrorism from external sources, Islamic terrorism, that sort of thing, and just relegate these lone wolf acts as acts of crazy people. Of course, to some extent it is, but it comes from this larger, persistent culture that's been around for many decades and is not going away anytime soon.
Mm-hmm. Professor Futrell, you mentioned Wade Michael Page. He's the person who shot six people, who killed six people, I should say, in a Sikh temple in 2012. Also, Frazier Glenn Miller Jr., who killed three at a Jewish community center in 2014. Are those, I'm just wondering how persistent their actions or the memory of their actions are in white supremacist circles. Are they still talked about amongst these groups?
Sure. In the same way that Dylann Roof gets talked about, again, some feeling that these are justified responses. But again, there's debate within this white supremacist community about what strategies are the best at this time or at any time, really. And it's been ongoing for quite a while. But what's happening more recently is that, you know, racial extremists, say like Richard Spencer or the Council for Conservative Citizens, have been working to sort of reframe their rhetoric to appeal to more moderate, more mainstream conservative whites who would otherwise disavow overt affiliation with white supremacy. So they're trying to neutralize the stigma that's been associated with white supremacy, and they do this by calling it Eurocentric pride or white heritage preservation or white nationalism or most recently alt-white. You know, this is sanitized white supremacy, and what they're doing is seeking to draw in patriotic white Americans, as they call them, and secure some degree of political power. And in this context, where you have the president-elect who, during the campaign, did things like retweet from an account called White Genocide TM, I mean, that is a clear signal, whether Donald Trump intended it or not, a clear signal to white supremacists that, as they've said on Stormfront, the white supremacist, largest white supremacist website, when he was elected, they say, we finally have one of us in the White House again. So the violence may be moderated while they seek this, you know, institutional power that they feel that they are entitled to. The complication is if they don't attain the kind of political power they feel entitled to during Trump's presidency, we may see a new wave of violence from those frustrated by the limits of institutionalized politics and more folks spinning out from this culture.
Hmm. Well, Robert Futrell is a professor of sociology at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and co-author of American Swastika, Inside the U.S. White Power Movement's Hidden Space of Hate. Professor Futrell, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Merriam-Webster picked surreal for their Word of the Year 2016. Dictionary.com picked xenophobia. But NPR Books editor Petra Mayer noticed another word bubbling up.
I feel like I've been seeing it everywhere, every 5 minutes. In tweets, online, in the news. Joe Jonas even wrote a song about it.
When you close that door, you see it's unhinged, it's just like me.
Unhinged. It seems like the adjective of choice for 2016 and the people who had to live through it. But maybe it's just me. Maybe it's like that thing where you buy a car and then you start seeing the same make of car on every corner. So I did what every good journalist does. I asked the library. And according to our extremely informal survey of online-only news sources, the word unhinged came up 615 times in 2014, 784 times the next year, and last year, wait for it, 2,017 times.
I want to tell you that I looked into dictionary.com's data on this too, and I think that you're on to something.
That's Jane Solomon, a lexicographer for dictionary.com. Solomon, like all the linguists I talked to, was very careful not to draw too many conclusions from my limited data. But she says there was a big spike of interest in December of 2015 when Jeb Bush called Donald Trump unhinged on Twitter. Then
the lookups were pretty normal, pretty steady throughout the year, until we get to fall 2016, when we see a steady rise in the term unhinged. And I was talking to one of our analytics people about this, and he and I both thought that this might have been related to the lead up to the election.
Both political parties were flinging unhinged around last year, but why that particular word?
If something is unhinged, it's no longer working as it used to. It is disconnected. It is coming apart.
That's John McIntyre, a language blogger and the night news editor for the Baltimore Sun.
And I think a lot of people, for example, during the presidential campaign, thought that things were getting unhinged.
McIntyre did caution me to watch out for what linguists call the recency illusion. That's that thing I was just talking about where you notice a word and suddenly it's everywhere.
It's a nice kind of simple metaphor. I mean, crazy is just crazy, but unhinged, you've got something happening right there.
That's Alan Metcalf, professor at McMurray College and executive secretary of the American Dialect Society. And while Metcalf agrees that I might be onto something, he also quotes me a fascinating passage from an issue of London Magazine published in 1772.
"We seem to see only a scene of universal debauch. The doors of profligacy are unhinged, and morality seems overwhelmed in its own ruins."
Seems just as applicable to life under Mad King George III as it does to the year we lost Prince. So that's my word of the year for 2016, unhinged. Petra Mayer, NPR News, Washington.
And so what would be yours? We mentioned surreal, unhinged. Leave your nomination for Word of 2016 with a comment with this story at herenow.org.
Severe storms swept through the South yesterday, causing extensive road and building damage and power outages in Mississippi, Louisiana, and Texas. The National Weather Service confirmed at least 12 tornadoes hit the region. One person drowned in Florida. And in southeastern Alabama, four people were killed in the town of Rehoboth. Jim Cook is a reporter with the Dothan Eagle, and he's on the scene in Rehoboth. And Jim, tell us what the area looks like now. What kind of damage are you seeing?
I guess it's kind of a testament to the randomness of these storms. You know, you'll see some houses that look perfectly fine, and then a house over, you'll see trees down in the yard and just, you know, damage to different areas of the structures.
So four people died in Rehoboth. What do we know about how they were killed, and who were they?
The names of the victims are Michelle Lewis, Amanda Blair, Tarina Brookshire, and Carla Rambert. They were gathered in a house where two of them lived with some other folks. There were seven people in the house when the storm happened, and a tree fell through, and four people died and three survived.
Well, how are officials responding to the weather there and all the damage that's been caused?
Right now they're assessing. There's crews out here. They're cleaning things up. They're just trying to keep people away from the area where it happened. The schools in the town where the fatalities occurred, you know, they closed for the day. The rest of the schools in the county system opened up an hour later, and that's about as far as I know.
Mm-hmm. And what's the weather like there today? What's the?
It's clear. It's clear today.
Well, that's a little bit of good news in comparison to the tough weather you've been seeing recently there. Jim Cook, reporter with the Dothan Eagle. Thank you so very much.
All right. Thank you.
Well, there are just 2.5 weeks to go until Donald Trump's inauguration as president of the United States. But he first got Secret Service protection more than a year ago during the primaries in November 2015. Since then, however, Trump has continued to use his own private security force in addition to the Secret Service. And that's something a former Secret Service agent calls like playing with fire. So what happens come January 20th once Donald Trump is sworn in? Well, Kenneth Vogel has been reporting on this story for Politico, and he joins us now from Washington. Hi, Ken. Welcome to the show.
Hey, great to be with you, Magna.
So first of all, tell us, how unusual is it for a president-elect to still be using a private security force in addition to the Secret Service?
Oh, it's extremely unusual, unprecedented even in my conversations with former Secret Service agents and folks who do this type of stuff for a living. They say that the instant that a presidential candidate ends up getting Secret Service protection, they dispense with any private security that they had previously. Even presidential candidates who are governors, who have state trooper protection, will minimize, if not eliminate, their state trooper protection in order to have Secret Service be the sole or at least the preeminent provider of security because, of course, the Secret Service is so well trained in this regard. They are really the gold standard. And why, frankly, would anyone want to have private security or any other security when they could have Secret Service protection?
Well, we know that the president-elect really prizes loyalty, perhaps amongst or above everything else. I mean, has he said why he's keeping his private security team around?
He certainly loyalty is a factor in our understanding and conversations with the folks around him. We've also seen that he has an intense interest in his security, particularly his rally security. You go to these rallies, both during the campaign and then after the campaign, he had this thank you tour. They're really raucous affairs. They often have protesters, and Trump likes to engage with the protesters, sometimes through the security from the stage. It was not uncommon at all for him to say, get them out, and to point to people who were protesting, and his private security would quickly swarm the protesters and remove them. Now, this gets into the sort of legal reason as to why he might want private security, and that is that Secret Service wouldn't do that. They wouldn't remove someone unless that person was deemed to be a threat from a rally. Sometimes you've had candidates who have private political rallies where they've had staff sort of fill that function, but staff certainly aren't as effective in physically handling protesters like these private security folks do. Many of them are former FBI agents, former big city police officers and detectives. And so that's one of the reasons why the Trump folks say, and they admit, that they like to have private security at private rallies in order to police these private rallies. And that's what they, that's their explanation as to why they continue to have these private security folks on board.
Okay, so there's a lot going on here, Ken. I mean, as you mentioned, we've got a private security force with different backgrounds in law enforcement, different training, of course, from the Secret Service itself. I mean, do we know how they're working together? I mean, who would be in charge in the event of an actual emergency around the president-elect's safety?
Yeah, it raised a lot of questions, and we see some congressional interest in possibly investigating this from the Secret Service perspective. The congressional committees have oversight over the Secret Service, and they are concerned about the protocols being followed or not being followed in this case and how that may confuse the chain of command and may even put Donald Trump at risk. There's an incident that a number of folks who we talked to were concerned about that they say really epitomizes the potential risks here, and it occurred in March at a rally, a Trump rally in Dayton, Ohio, where a protester jumped the barricades and rushed the stage while Secret Service agents instantly swarmed. This guy tackled him to the ground while other Secret Service agents formed a human wall around Donald Trump. And just a split second later, Trump's private director of security, a guy by the name of Keith Schiller, former New York City cop, runs out and sort of positions himself between where the ruckus is taking place off stage and where Trump is surrounded by the Secret Service folks. It looked to the naked eye, it certainly looked to me like, hey, this is a bunch of guys working in concert with each other in a well-choreographed way. But the security experts who I spoke to and the former Secret Service agents who I spoke to said, no, if you look where Trump's private security guy came from, that would have been the direction to which the Secret Service would have evacuated Trump had they felt the need to do that in that situation. And were that to have happened, they would have run smack into Trump's private security guy, who in this case was either not on the same page as the Secret Service or just frankly not as quick in reacting as the Secret Service.
Huh. Now you mentioned Keith Schiller. He's been the director of security for the Trump Organization since what, 2004, right? So quite some time.
Correct.
Okay. Do we know if he or the rest of Trump's private security force that he still has around him have the same oath, or I mean, as the Secret Service does, because the Secret Service, of course, famously swears to take a bullet for the president if necessary.
Yeah, that's right. And we don't know that. In fact, there are some lawsuits that are ongoing that are trying to get at this question of the training of Trump security folks. And we also filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the Secret Service to determine what the operational agreements are between the private security during the campaign, as well as the transition and possibly going forward into the White House, because Keith Schiller, we understand, is going to take a job in the White House that will have sort of a hybrid staff slash security type of function to it. So we want to know exactly how the Secret Service is treating this and what types of requirements there are, if any, from the Secret Service for Trump's private security. A lot of unanswered questions that we're trying to get to the bottom of still.
Well, tell us more about Keith Schiller then, because you've reported that he's sort of more than, as you said, more than security, that oftentimes when people want to get through to Trump, they call Keith Schiller first.
Yeah, that's right. We talked to folks who call him the most important person who no one's ever heard of. This is a guy who was a New York City police detective in the narcotics unit who joined Trump, the Trump Organization, which is the corporate entity, as a bodyguard part-time while he was still working as a New York City cop in 1999, eventually became full-time, later became the head of security, has traveled with Trump all over the world, has a great relationship with the guy. Again, this gets back to loyalty. Trump feels very comfortable with him. We talk to folks around Trump who say that often after meeting that Schiller will sit in key meetings, and often after the meeting, Trump will turn to him and be like, hey, what'd you think, Keith? So this is a guy who obviously has a security function, but also a staff function, and even to some extent a personal relationship that may transcend both of those. And so he's a subject of a lot of interest, I think, as folks try to figure out how Trump world works. Who is this guy? What is he doing? What is his job? What is his background? What is his connection to Trump? It's, you know, questions that I think we delved into a little bit and explained a little bit in our piece, but we'll continue to look at.
Right. And Ken, in the last couple seconds that we have, I mean, what does the Secret Service have to say about this? Could they nix Trump's private security come January 20th?
The Secret Service already is casting this as a situation where they are the preeminent entity in this relationship and saying that anyone else who is working around Trump is doing so in a staff function. But I can tell you from my personal perspective, having gone out on the victory tour trail and watching Keith Schiller remove some of these people while also accompanying Trump with the Secret Service detail, it doesn't look like that.
Kenneth Vogel, chief investigative reporter at Politico, thank you.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
This week, around 200,000 people will make their way to Las Vegas for the Consumer Electronics Show. The CES officially opens Thursday. It's one of the most well-known shows in the tech industry. It raises a curtain on the future. And this year, it's celebrating its past. This is the 50th anniversary. Here with a preview is our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Ina Fried, senior editor at Recode, is here. Hi, Ina.
Hi, Robin.
And this is a great way to gauge advances because I'm imagining some of the things showcased at the, 1967 CES would have been just dreams, but we have them now. So what else has the CES been significant for over the years?
Well, it used to really be a bellwether for where technology was going. Bill Gates used to give the opening keynote, and really it was sort of set the scene for what's next. The tech industry has grown, of course, to really dominate all aspects of modern life. So in some ways, CES isn't quite what it once was. At the same time, because so much of our lives depend on technology, more types of things get shown. So what used to be gadgets and computers became cell phones. Now it's washing machines of the future. Mm. It's Internet of Things. It's a lot of cars. So it's really broadened the scope of what it covers.
Well, and it's funny, too, because you can see something that might have been there 50 years ago, and it's still evolving. You know, so what will you be watching for the most?
So I think where smarts are going. So everything is becoming smart. That's a cliche, but we're really starting to see that. So we're starting to see, you know, years ago we talked about connected washing machines, connected ovens, and people wondered why would we ever do that? And a lot of the talk was about repairs and so forth. Now we're seeing a lot of these things. You're sending recipes straight from your phone and apps to the oven. You are seeing, you know, washing machines that can send for repair information, all these kinds of things. So I'll be watching for what devices are getting needless smarts and what are getting useful smarts. I think that, to me, is the key question. I also think some of the things that have been standalone devices, so Amazon's Alexa speaker that's part of Echo, its own speaker line, that Alexa smarts is going into all kinds of gear. And I'm interested to see where, and I hate this cliche, but where does 1 + 1 add up to more than 2?
No, that's a fine cliche. By the way, this is the Internet of Things that, you know, you were mentioning. And I'm wondering, too, how much this news we had over the past year about how hackers can get into your life through your smart devices, you know, your baby monitor. So wondering if that'll impact that field. But what about smart watches? Did they really take off?
They really haven't. And I think they're one category that I think the technology is there in terms of miniaturization. You can put a computer on your wrist. The question is, what do you do with that? And, you know, our phones are so useful and so powerful. I don't think the industry has actually come up with a clear reason. Fitness tracking is the best thing we've come up with. And it's enough for some segment of people to buy something. It's not enough to keep it out of our drawers. So to me, what technology will not only sell smartwatches, but keep us wearing them? That's what I'm watching for.
What about cars? The CES is kind of encroaching on the territory of the big car shows. There's so many, you know, cars there now. We're going to expect to hear from, you know, traditional car companies, Ford, Toyota. What are you looking for?
So I think, you know, it definitely is a car show. It goes straight into the big auto show. But, you know, this is where we hear about the technology side. There's two things that are really happening, or at least two big things. One is the cars of today are getting tremendously more connected, both in terms of entertainment stuff, so connecting to your phone, your music, your apps, as well as parts of self-driving. So they can park themselves or they can keep you from going in your lane. But the other piece is autonomous cars being designed from the ground up to never have a driver. And so we're really seeing two different paths, and both will be on display in Vegas.
Yeah.
The second path being cars that literally are designed to never be driven.
Yeah. I just want to make sure we've asked you about mobile, because that's your beat. And we're seeing more and more Chinese makers going into the mobile market. That's supposed to be even more so this year. Is the industry leery of the Donald Trump talk of tariffs on China? Americans aren't going to be able to afford, you know, American phones if parts can't be made cheaply in China. So take that whole piece.
Well, obviously, it's a pretty complex subject, but to me, it can be best summed up by the faces of the technology executives in that meeting with Donald Trump. So, yes, they all flew to meet with Donald Trump, but you look at those pained expressions. I think Silicon Valley, you know, on the outside, they're trying to work with this new administration. And I think they're, you know, deeply fearful. They live in, you know, we talk about a global world and globalization. The technology industry at large, and then mobile specifically, is an incredibly global. As you point out, everything's made in China. There would be no iPhone without China. There's no easy way to replace that. For all of Donald Trump's talk, it's not like you could build iPhones in the U.S. tomorrow. So I think the technology industry really wants the status quo when it comes to U.S.-China relations.
Ina Fried, senior editor at Recode. Ina, thanks as always.
Thanks, Robin.
We'll have you back to talk about TVs. I do not understand HDR 4K OLED. You'll come back for that. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young. Jeremy Hobson's away.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.